Welcome to In Their Own Words, the audio memories of leading members of the British Tennis Journalists Association. In this edition, Richard Evans talks about his remarkable career, which includes writing alongside Althea Gibson in the Evening Standard and discovering Yannick Noah while travelling in Africa with Arthur Ashe. He was allowed in this edition one mention of his beloved Arsenal. Richard, you have had the most remarkable career, both in tennis and out of tennis. And it started with one of the great names of tennis, Althea Gibson.
It did indeed. And I repeated this often, as ridiculous, timing is everything. Reg Hayter, for whom I was working before I went in the army, got me a job on the Evening Standard as rugby and rowing correspondent virtually the day I was demobbed. And I walked in on the Friday of what was then Queen's, no week between Queen's and Wimbledon. So 3 days before Wimbledon, to find the sports editor, Peter Goodall, talking to the editor of the paper, who was Charles Wintour, who might be more easily recognizable to this generation as the father of Anna Wintour, who is a huge name, editor of Vogue in journalism in America and here. And he, the conversation was a bit fraught because he was saying to Peter, we don't have anyone to write Althea's copy on Monday. What are we going to do? Then he turned and he saw me coming across the news desk and said, well, you've got a young man joining the paper, give him to Althea. And that changed my life because I was not supposed to be writing tennis. I had never written tennis. With Reg Hayter's organization, I'd been on football and rugby and cricket and everything you can think of, but not tennis. Anyway, I was dispatched to the Queen's Club, where I've been all week. It looks very different today. And I was to introduce myself to this tall, elegant black lady, who, of course, had won Wimbledon a couple of years before. And that started my tennis writing, because I just sat next to Althea on the center court at Wimbledon and copied down what she said. And off we went. Just for 1 year, then the next year it was Jaroslav Drobny who taught me a lot about tennis. He was the professor.
And getting that sort of introduction to tennis, Richard, you can't see that happening these days. It was unique, wasn't it, to be that close to players and to be able to spend time with them?
Totally and utterly different. I mean, it's hard to understand today that the players travelled alone. There were no coaches, no trainers, no agents, the occasional parent, the occasional wife or girlfriend. But basically, they were a band of young men and women who traveled the world, picking up what they could from free hospitality and towards the end, just before open tennis, of underhand payments. Shamateurism became the thing. You said, yes, I'll play your tournament, but it's a 500. And Roy Emerson and Manolo Santana set that. I think in the end, they played for $1,000 a week. But as we were traveling, I think Barry Lorge, the late American reporter from San Diego, traveled a bit on the WCT tour. And various other of my colleagues used to sort of jump on and off the tour. But I, for a time, was quite consistently traveling, especially in those early days of WCT. And so what did one do in the evening? One all went out to dinner. I couldn't begin to tell you how many times I sat down to dinner with Rod Laver and John Newcombe and Roy Emerson and Arthur Ashe. I mean, it was just a traveling group. And because they came to trust me, they were perfectly natural and knew that I knew the borders of what I should write and what I shouldn't write off court. On court, I wrote what I wanted. And if I thought they played badly, I said they played badly. And, you know, that was a very special group of players. The Australians, with people like Arthur Ashe thrown in, Tom Ocker, a few others. But that group of Harry Hopman's Aussies, Lou Hoad, Ken Rosewall, Ashley Cooper, John Newcombe, Rod Laver, Roy Emerson, Fred Stolle, Tony Roach, John Newcombe, you can just go on and on. And they were a wonderful bunch of people to be around. So I was just very lucky.
And what were the working facilities like at that point at the various events you went to, including the Grand Slams, for journalists?
Rudimentary, I think, would be a kind way of putting it. Places like Queen's, you had a sort of press room in the basement. and Wimbledon. We had a nice press room and Forest Hills, the press box. You couldn't really see the court. Apart from that, it was pretty good. We got fed. Occasionally we didn't. And always the big problem was the votes. You know, were there enough votes? I mean, going into your sport, Chris, the Metropolitan Police rugby ground on a very wet Wednesday afternoon with a soggy notebook and a pencil that didn't work. And you literally had to go and knock on someone's door, those houses down the bottom of the ground, and say, do you mind if I use your telephone? And a few doors were slammed in your face and you missed the audition. It was, working for the Evening Standard again, we have all this in common. There were additions every hour. And so it was a little bit of pressure. That's why, luckily, if one thing I learned was to be on time, because if you sneezed, you missed an audition. But it really was the communications that was the big problem. And we somehow got over it. We shared phones. We hoped the call went through from Italy, and often it didn't. And somehow got the words into the paper. There was one glorious story, which actually isn't about tennis, but it was about covering a match at Lansdowne Road. You may have read it, but being Irish, they decided that the best way to get the copy out was to have us sit on lavatory seats and shove the copy down between our legs to a little lad below who caught it and picked up the phone and phoned it to London. And I was there for the Evening Standard. Steve Roberts was there for the Evening News. And Ross McWhirter of the McWhirters was doing it for the Star. I think that was how it worked. Anyway, so we did this and down went the copy between our legs and the little boy was in his Irish accent phoning it all through. And it all seemed to work. And we caught the last flight out to London. I remember all three of us, we grabbed our newspapers at Heathrow to see, as one did, to see what had got into the paper. And of course, the poor lad had sent my copy to the Evening News, Ross McWhirter's to the Evening Standard, and got everything mixed up. But we just, what do? You laugh.
Richard, you talked about meeting Althea. Someone else that you got very close to, and it's a personality I know which became a dominant personality because he was just such a lovely guy, was Arthur Ashe. Can you just talk about how you got to know Arthur and some of the trips you went to Africa with him?
Yes, Arthur was a very special human being. I first caught a glimpse of him, the old number one court. I was walking down that corridor and you could just see over the seats of the people. And I looked over and I saw this very slim young black man, although he was very young. And I thought, oh, that must be Arthur Ashe, because I'd heard about him, but I'd never actually seen him. And then, again, being around, one just got to know Arthur, although he wasn't an extrovert. But as he learned to get to know you, he was a fascinating personality in every way, with a very quiet, but quite cute sense of humor. And quickly we realized that he was a bit special and he was a little bit apart. I don't think any of us realized what he was going through. I was astonished, having got to know him well enough to be sleeping in his apartment in New York and he stayed at my apartment in Paris, when he said a few years before he died that every time he walked onto the street in Manhattan, I knew I was a black man. Which, surprised me because he has assimilated himself so well into the white community. And he was a totally lily white community. There weren't any other black players when he came into it. Men, obviously, there was Althea before. And then, yes, Donald Dell organized these trips to Africa through the State Department. And we went to English-speaking Africa, and then French-speaking Africa. And then finally, after a huge performance of diplomatic cables and God knows what else, and Owen Williams going to the president of South Africa and saying, please, give Arthur a visa because he's harmless. He's not going to come and blow up the country. And so off we set. And those trips were amazing, and obviously the most amazing thing to come out of them was the discovery of Yannick Noah in Yaoundé, who we discovered one dark night that he was hitting balls with his uncle And Charlie Passerell, Arthur Ashe, and myself just happened to pass that court. We could have gone the other way to the clubhouse for dinner, and you would never have heard of Yannick Noah as a tennis player. He'd have played football like his dad did for Cameroon. And Arthur stopped and said, "Let's have a look at this bloke." And he said, "Yeah, okay." And he pulled out that head racket, that steel head racket, like Excalibur from its sheath, and called the little boy over, the 11-year-old, and said, "Here, try this." And so he flung his battered Dunlop Max Fly aside, and Yannick Noah then played the most important point of his life. With Arthur's racket in his hand, he went back to the baseline, wiped off some large moths in this, you know, tropical heat, and put in a huge first serve and came charging in and put away a backhand volley. And Arthur, who was not given to great exclamations of amazement, said, "Kid can play." And went into the clubhouse, said, "Who's the boy?" And they said, "There's his father." And he spoke to his father and said, "Your son can play tennis, but he's not going to get anywhere here. And he's got to go to America or France or somewhere." And Mr. Noah said, "Well, that's easy. His mother lives in Nice." And within 6 weeks, having spoken to Philippe Chatrier on our return, Yannick was installed with mum at the Federation's first training center outside Paris. They'd just opened it. And the rest, I won't use the cliche. Anyway, Arthur was fascinating. What he did in South Africa was amazing. I mean, he was then in his late 20s, but handling that political, God, I don't know how to pronounce it. He was walking a tightrope because everybody was watching him. The Afrikaner government were nervous. And Don Matera, the poet who wrote the most amazingly insightful poem about Arthur, had arranged this meeting with black journalists in a hall. And laughably, the South African government had got a banning order on Don Matera because of something he'd written. And it came out right when they didn't want it to, right in the middle of Arthur Ashe's visit, because they were trying desperately to show the world what a wonderful place apartheid South Africa was. And they're right in the middle of it. Arthur was stopped going into the meeting that Don Matera had organized by Don, saying, "Arthur, I'm sorry, I can't come into the meeting with you because I'm banned, and I'm only allowed to speak to one person at a time." And we all then got a close-up of what apartheid was like in South Africa. But he walked into that meeting, and there was a lot of acrimony. Somebody called out Uncle Tom, and a lot of people said, "What are you doing here? You're just feeding into the government's line of thinking." And Arthur had to handle this, and it was a packed meeting and a heat, and it was really one of the most extraordinary situations I've been in. And Arthur was so cool. I mean, he was taught so well by Dr. Johnson growing up, who said, "Never let the white man have an excuse to criticize you." And many black people wouldn't have been able to follow that, nor would they have wanted to. But Arthur felt that was his path. He had the temperament to be able to handle that. And so he was able to handle that meeting, but many people wouldn't have been able to.
Talking about politics, and being in such an amazing situation with Arthur, you yourself then moved into politics reporting-wise in America. How did that come about? Because you then started following presidential elections, didn't you? But also still doing tennis.
Well, yeah, it was, I don't know, you tell me, you make these decisions in life. I was married to the beautiful lady on the Londoner's Diary called Glenys Roberts, who we broke the Beaverbrook rule and got married. You weren't supposed to do that on a people book paper. But Charles Winter, this is sort of terribly haughty man, had another side to it. He just glossed over it and said, "No, that's fine, that's fine." So we got married when we were still on the Evening Standard. And then we looked at each other at the age of 25 and said, "Is this what we want to do for the rest of our lives?" Because I joined at the age of 21, Glenys the same. And I thought, you know, this is, I've got a fabulous job, you know, your job, you've done it. You know what a great job is with great people. The rugby people in those days, I'm sure they're great now, but that was a really great bunch in the 60s with all my pals at Richmond and London Scottish and everything. But I thought, if we don't make a move now, we're going to have children, we're going to have a mortgage, and we're going to be here forever because we can do the job. We know we can do the job. So he took an enormous deep breath, went to Charles and said, we're leaving. And he said, what on earth for? Which was a very good question. And I'd been to America once, and I was fascinated by it. And so had Glenys. And we said, okay, let's go to New York. And I think the thing that gave me the strength to do it was that I'd started doing some freelance work for CBS Radio during Wimbledon. Somebody called me up out of the blue, I have no idea who it was, and said, CBS Worldwide Sports need a minutes report on Wimbledon every night. You'll do it from Broadcasting House at 11 p.m. So that was in the second year, that was 1961. And I started doing that. So I made this connection with CBS. And that gave me the courage, I suppose, to think, well, if I do go to America, I've got some contacts. Because the producer was a wonderful guy called John Channon. He said, yeah, if you come over here, we can use you. So off we set on the SS France and went to New York. And it was very difficult to start with, to say the least. I had a heart attack every time I looked at my bank balance, but Glenys freelanced. And then, sometimes there's an angel up there looking after you, because I'd started doing some freelance work for John Gold, who was the evening news correspondent in New York. And against all norms, and you can tell me if you can think of one, but I can't think of another reporter in the field who was appointed editor of the paper back home just like that overnight. I mean, they go back and they spend, a year maybe on the, as assistant editor or something like that. But I don't know what happened in London, but they called up John Gold and said, we want you back here, you're editing the paper. So John went, and before he left, he turned round and he said, do you want my job? And I became evening news correspondent in America, the only one, the whole country, the whole shooting match. And I mean, needless to say, it was a lifesaver. Our marriage didn't quite survive, but we're still very good friends. And I started writing everything I had to. I mean, I was at the United Nations, I went down to Washington, and I ended up in those early years covering the presidential election of 68. And then all those incredible stories, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, who I campaigned with for several weeks before he was killed, the space shots, the riots in Newark, getting the shot at, I think they were firing anyway, I don't know, the shooting at me, Detroit going up in flames, Chicago 68, the police beating up the kids in Grant Park after Bobby had been killed, and getting hit over the head by my policeman during the marches against Nixon. So I became an all-round reporter. I had to. That was the job. I was a foreign correspondent overnight. And luckily, I was able to maintain my links to tennis, because Ted Tinling, the one and only Ted, who was one of the most incredible people I've ever met in my life, a great friend, introduced me to Gladys Hellman, who was publisher of World Tennis Magazine, and who created with Billie Jean King the WTA Tour. And she wanted someone, she said, would you cover Forest Hills for me? She was using, I think Gardner Malloy was doing it. He was a player, for those of you who don't know. And I started writing for World Tennis Magazine, and I was able to maintain my link with tennis. John Gold, it was wonderful having him as editor, because he knew me and he allowed me to go back to London for Queens and Wimbledon every year that I was doing it. So I maintained my links with tennis. Then eventually I was transferred to the Paris office, and they closed the Paris office for financial reasons. And I was freelancing. And one day we had the Wimbledon boycott, of course, and obviously had a little bit of an inside thing, because I knew everybody so well who were in the basement of the Westbury Hotel till 1 o'clock in the morning trying to decide whether to boycott Wimbledon or not. To say it was fraught would be an understatement. And after that, about 6 months later, Arthur and Jack Cramer came to me and said, you know, we took a beating in the media over the Wimbledon boycott. We need someone who knows about PR. Would you like to join the ATP, which had just been formed? And so I left journalism for about 4 years and worked for the ATP, basically as European director.
So I can't let you go on that story of Wimbledon while working in New York and Washington without 1972. And it's been described as, thanks to a red sports car, two girlfriends, a fellow journalist, and a last minute seating on a 747, you managed to come over and do the Stan Smith Ilya Anastasi match and almost miss your flight back.
Oh, yes, I nearly missed my flight back because Stan wouldn't hurry up and win the bloody match, would he? And so I remember Jerry Williams, dear Jerry, was sitting in front of me because I had to go and I didn't see match point. It was literally 2 points away. And I said, Jerry, if anything desperate happens, can you cover for me? And he said, yeah, yeah, off you go. And I did have this girlfriend who'd taken my Triumph sports car to London Airport. No, I drove to London Airport. That's right. I had the car parked just across the road, drove to London Airport. She was waiting for me. I literally threw the keys at her and made the flight by 5 minutes. Which was the sort of thing you could do in those days because you didn't have to go through security. And then I grabbed the papers when I got to New York and overnight wrote up what everybody was talking about was going on at the convention in Miami and had a byline the next day in the evening news from New York. And I think sort of one or two people who read bylines, which aren't many, probably thought, I thought he was at Wimbledon. Anyway, those were crazy days, but lots of fun.
The administration of tennis, I know you are unique in that you had that position with the ATP and then came back into journalism. Is it being run as well as it could be at the moment? And has it been, well, has it been better run over the years?
Oh, I think it's better. Just there have been moments when, I mean, the best leader we ever had was Jack Cramer in those early days, but tennis was in such a mess and there was still so much political infighting. It's so much better than that. Marshall Happer's written his great book. He details all those years. But Butch Buchholz and I tried to get all the parties together in one room, which we did twice in Houston and Miami, trying to create a Tennis Inc., one central office with a commissioner, with all the parties, you know, feeding into it. And we failed. There were a couple of people in the room who represented very large organizations who just weren't interested because they were worried about their fiefdom. And they didn't want to give up any control or influence. And so we actually had Senator George Mitchell come into the Miami meeting and he just solved Northern Ireland. If you can solve Northern Ireland, you should be able to solve tennis, but he couldn't, which is sad because we're all in the game trying to make it better. You know, most of us are friends. It is getting better. We got tie breaks that are now all the same at all four Grand Slams. What an achievement. But really, it should be much more coordinated and speaking with one voice. But, you know, it's an enormous game now, much bigger game than people realize. It's the third watched sport in the world. It could be even bigger. Charlie Passarell years ago said, we don't punch our weight. So many people play, so many people watch, and it's got an attraction. It's never lost this attraction. I've just written a history of tennis book. You go through these periods where you think everything is coming together and then something else happens. But it will survive. It will get better. And covering the sport is becoming a major problem. COVID was a big blow to the whole process because obviously suddenly we couldn't go anywhere. And now tournaments are using that as an excuse to reduce our accessibility to players, which I've said this so many times. We had it in Paris where we weren't allowed to go into the players' restaurant. It is the players who lose out more than the journalists by not having informal contact with the players. It is obvious, and you can't contradict this statement, that if you know someone as a person, you are going to not only be better informed when you write about them, but a little gentler. If you know that someone is going through some problems that he doesn't really want to talk about, but sort of confided in you, if he makes a mess of it on court and misbehaves or loses badly, you're going to write about it with greater wisdom and greater understanding. And so by separating us completely, it's the players who lose out, let alone the young journalist coming into the sport. I've been talking to some young man from Morocco who's now working for the LTA. He's desperate to get into writing about tennis. But when he does, he won't be able to get to know a player. There won't be a way for him to become an acquaintance, let alone a friend. We're not talking about bosom buddies. We're just an acquaintance of a tennis player, because all you get is the press conference. And that is very detrimental to what used to go on. I mean, if we want to talk about, our colleagues from way back, an amusing anecdote and an example, not a very good one, actually, as far as watching tennis and writing about what you saw. Dear Frank Rostrum, Daily Express, amazing man, boxed for South Africa, was a war correspondent all the way up through Italy. And covering Roland Garros, he was a racing fanatic. So, of course, Longchamp is across the road. And he used to go and watch the horses all afternoon, come back at 5 o'clock. Frank, if you remember him, he always had his hat over one ear, racing cards and newspapers stuck under his arm, come bustling into Roland Garros and walk straight into the locker room without any question. No one stopped him, and talk to a couple of players, get an exclusive, and beat us all to the big story. And of course, we're not very happy about that. But that was an example of the exact opposite of what could possibly happen today. You can't walk into locker rooms, nor should you, but you can't even walk into a player's lounge in some tournaments. Some are better than others, but it is a major problem for the sport, for the players, as well as the media, if we're not allowed just to mingle, stand in line for a coffee, say, do you like Arsenal's victory yesterday? I mean, just chat like normal human beings without this suspicion of you're going to get done by some reporter looking for an angle. That is why we created ITWA, why we created the International Tennis Writers Association, to do the job for them. And I'm talking about the press staff at tournaments, because their big complaint was, you're going to get the sun coming in here. And no, you're not, if they are policed. And to join ITWA, you have to be a full-time tennis writer covering 14 tennis tournaments a year. And if you don't meet that criteria, you can't join ITWA, and therefore you can't get into player lounges. We did the job for them. They don't have to make the decision of which reporter is allowed in and which isn't, because we do that job for them. And in most tournaments, it works. It's definitely been a huge plus. But now we're finding this attitude, and I think the agents are hugely to blame, and the tournament directors are nervous because they think we must please the players. And there are always, in any group, you get a couple who complain. And otherwise, I have never heard of a major problem of a player complaining about a reporter being in the same restaurant or the same bar or whatever. But there are always a couple, and one young man who sticks out because he's 6'11", decided to slam the entire profession of tennis writing, which was an incredibly stupid thing to do, seeing we will decide how he is presented to the public. That was pretty stupid, but he's an exception. Most players are fine with having real tennis writers around. And hopefully we can get that message across. It is a difficult one.
Finally, Richie, the great passion of your life is in red. It plays in North London. Have you had more joy out of following tennis or following Arsenal over the years?
Oh, that's a good question. No, I mean, I've been so intertwined with tennis that I think the highlights, Arthur Ashe winning Wimbledon, and all that excitement and the great tournaments. It's a different sort of feeling. If you follow a football club, you become strangely emotionally attached for no good reason, really. I mean, I'm happier over a weekend if Arsenal won. There's no question. I'm just happier. It's stupid. It's got no basis in emotional reasoning, but that's how it is. And cricket, I mean, frankly, I think cricket is the greatest game in the world. Tennis can be the same. Football can be the same. They're my three favorite sports, and I get a huge amount of enjoyment out of being a spectator for a couple and very deeply involved with another.